Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Earlier this week, this was a huge story on our show. Governor Lamont announced the appointing of 25 people to serve as members of the newly formed Connecticut Hate Crimes Advisory Council. Created by a recently adopted state law, this council is responsible for encouraging and coordinating programs to increase community awareness and report hate crimes to combat these crimes from happening. And look, it's no real secret. We've been talking about just in New York City alone, all the Asian American hate crimes, Pacific Islanders, and unfortunately, Connecticut is also unfortunately guilty of this. We do see hate crimes happen. We have seen, especially on our Jewish communities, we have found symbolism, Nazi symbolism. We have seen swastikas at schoolyards, at synagogues, and even on school laptops, lockers. I mean, it's getting out of hand. It exists, and I think this council could not come at a better time. Joining me now is one of the 25 members. You probably know him very well, and that is Gary McNamara. He is the former chief of police from Fairfield Police Department, now working at Sacred Heart University. Gary, welcome to the show. How are you?
I am fine. I am well. Melissa, great to speak with you, and thanks for having me on this morning.
Yeah, it's been a while, Gary. I was telling my listeners, last time you and I chatted were my days at News 12, so it's nice to have you on the show. I'm glad to have
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Yes, and I'm an avid listener, so it's great to actually be on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So first of all, Gary, let's talk about your background. I think there's a big reason, you know, I think the governor could have picked many different people to be on this council. Obviously, he picked you for a reason. Could you talk about maybe what you're bringing to the table with your background in law enforcement and where you could provide just some substance to this group?
Yeah, I'm very lucky, consider myself lucky and glad that I am appointed. I think there's a lot of good individuals that could be appointed. So I'm fortunate to just be one of them. But yeah, I have a big law enforcement background, a diverse career, a variety of different positions I've held. And, you know, I remember, you know, bigotry and hate crimes are nothing new. I mean, I remember as a young detective investigating a swastika incident on a car, painted on a car, and students had done it at one of the high schools, and remember investigating it and actually applying for a warrant based upon a hate crime statute. Now, I don't remember the results of it, but the crime is nothing new. It just seems to be increasing. So I think, you know, I bring a law enforcement experience. Now I bring my experiences at the university, and I'm certainly willing and want to be engaged and continue to be engaged in matters that can have impact. And I think you have to bring compassion, you have to bring understanding, and you have to bring a perspective that you may not feel the impact of the crime that you hear about. But for those people in specific groups that hate crime is directed towards, it has great impact throughout the community. Mm. And you have to be very understanding of that. It impacts people differently. And if you're not a member of that group, you might not necessarily have that same perspective of how deep it hurts and how life-changing it can be.
You know what I find interesting, Gary, is and maybe you could speak to this. You know, you just said yourself, even from your early days of being on the force, you know, these hate crimes are not new. It is unfortunate that we've seen an uptick in Asian American and Pacific Islander crimes because of COVID. But I'm curious, you know, why now? Why create a council now? Granted, I know that wasn't your decision. You're one of the members on it. But, you know, could you maybe weigh in on the fact that I'm glad Connecticut is doing something, but my God, this has been an issue for a really long time in Connecticut and across the country.
Yeah, you know, I think it's just a matter of it just becoming, you know, a larger issue and really probably as simple as that. Probably should have been something that was developed a long time ago. You know, there's something we talk about when we talk about safety in a critical incident. And we talk about everybody's role, responding officers and firefighters and everybody that responds is responsible for safety. But in large incidents, there is a safety officer, someone who is designated to focus on the safety of the responders. And similar to this group, everybody in public service and in our community should be aware of hate crimes and what they can do to stop it and to bring awareness to it. But but everybody should do it. But if nobody's focused on it, it sometimes gets lost. And I think that this group will allow people to focus on it. This group is specifically designed to come together, bring awareness, develop programs, and if legislation has to be changed, you know, maybe we can put forward some ideas on what might be able to do that. But if everybody does it, sometimes nobody does it. So mm-hmm. I think this is a perfect timing for this, given what we're hearing throughout the news.
Gary McNamara is here. He's one of the 25 members representing the Connecticut Hate Crimes Advisory Council. This was a big announcement this week. And Gary, I'm curious, what do you hope happens? You know, from your background being in Fairfield's police department and what you saw on the job for so many years, maybe not necessarily in Fairfield, but certainly all across Connecticut, you're very much in touch with law enforcement across our state. What are you hoping gets accomplished?
Well, I mean, the ultimate goal would be to reduce the numbers of crimes that are committed. But, you know, larger than that is to have a broader discussion on what some of these issues are and some of these problems are. A lot of people are talking, but, you know, one of the best things about communication, the most important things is listening. And I think a lot of oftentimes what we all do is we all talk and we sometimes talk over each other. So I think what we need to do is ultimately at the end of the day, if my time on this council, you know, when I close the book on it, if I could sit there and say that I've had impact in some better understanding and changing the dialogue and changing the understanding, we can prosecute the crimes, but we can continue to prosecute the crimes. The ultimate goal is to stop the crimes from occurring in the first place. Mm-hmm. These have devastating effects to the community and to individuals. And, you know, the motive and the intent are really sometimes very brutal. So, that's the ultimate goal, is to stop it from occurring in the first place. How do you do that? A better understanding of what it means and what actually you are doing and the impact that it has if you're committing these type of incidents.
And I agree with that, Gary McNamara. I do agree that especially when you're talking about like swastikas and you find them at schools, a lot of times, unfortunately, it is young people. And whether they're punks, whether they just think they're being funny, or whether they truly don't understand the weight of their actions, you're right. Education is certainly important. But I am curious if from your perspective, you know, a lot of people have said, why aren't there harsher punishments? Even if it is for younger people, like, doesn't that also send a stronger message like, hey, you can't just spray paint and think, oh, I'm going to get a slap on the wrist and don't do that again. Like, is there more that could be done, though, on the penalty side?
Well, you're talking my language, Melissa. And I think that punishment and penalties certainly are a great deterrent, number one, and it sends a message. So I am all for significant punishment now, especially when it comes to these crimes because of the devastating effect. There are statutes in place, but they have to be utilized. And that is... So what we need to do is we need to do a really – and we do a good job, but we need to continue to do a good job when police and responders respond to incidents. They always have to have their eye open for motive. Now, so if there is a hint of a bias crime or a hate crime motive, they have to implement that. They have to charge that, and it has to be prosecuted. Sure, you know, there are those incidents where people do it and they don't really understand what they're doing. They should, you know, bring awareness to it and the like. But at the same time, the way you stop this is people that are really driving hate and driving bigotry and committing acts of that intimidate and that cause harm and violence. I mean, they got to be prosecuted, absolutely. And there should be a clear message said that if you do this and if you're found guilty of it, this is going to be the punishment. That's where you're going to start to stop it.
I was curious, Gary, with your background. Any idea, or could you kind of give us even like a ballpark estimate, where does Connecticut stand with hate crimes as far as like nationwide? Are we one of the, I don't want to say better states, worse states? Like, I mean, one hate crime is enough to say there's a problem, but where do we fall? Like, I know next door in New York City, it's looking horrible when it comes to like Asian American hate crimes right now. It has some of the highest upticks in the last year. Where does Connecticut sort of fall, and what groups would you say are most under attack here in our state?
I think, you know, it's hard to say where we fall. I don't really have that information, but I don't think we're an outlier either way. I think we're kind of probably experiencing what other states kind of mid-range would be experiencing. As far as the groups go, I think it's similar to what we're seeing nationwide. I think there's always these these groups, these individuals that hate others, to specifically for, you know, their race, their religion, and, you know, sexual orientation. So I think those groups always exist. And I think it's really the, unfortunately, the flavor of the month. It's whatever is getting that whatever's highlighted in the media and on social media begins to see that uptick. Mm-hmm. You know, Asian crime is on an uptick. And here's the thing, Melissa. We know that it's underreported, okay? And then the other thing is it's the perception and it's the fear. So you don't need the crime to be committed in Connecticut to have the effect mm-hmm. in Connecticut. Because people will read that, you know, people of Asian descent will read about a crime that occurred while someone's just literally going shopping, walking down the sidewalk in New York City, and that will have an effect on them. That'll have mm-hmm. an effect on their community and on their family. So sometimes we try to dissect it a little too much, and I'm not saying you're doing that. We want data. We want information so we know the amount of the problem. But sometimes we have to understand that, again, the crime doesn't have to occur here to have an effect here. And that's really what we want to spread the word. And those questions you're asking are one of the many specific reasons why our council, I think, can have impact. Mm-hmm. Is to spread awareness that it doesn't matter if it's happening in your own backyard. It's happening and people are learning about it and it's having an impact, negative impact on our community.
That's a great point, Gary. It's a great way to look, because you're right. You're absolutely right that as soon as it's even in the headlines anywhere, it could be happening anywhere across our globe, really. And you're right. It sends a trickling effect. You're right in saying that, and I appreciate that. I'm just curious, Gary, before we wrap up, again, I know that this is very, very early on. The council was literally just announced a couple of days ago. I'm just curious, you know, what are you hoping to either propose? Like, I know, you know, one of the biggest things I'm reading here is coordinating programs. What would be your idea of making more community awareness? I know you were saying education is super key, letting people know really the depth of their actions and understanding other backgrounds and people that they're attacking. What would be your advice? What do you think could change?
I think we need to reach those individuals in our communities that don't think it affects them. You know, I walk a mile in her shoes for domestic violence, and I do that. One of the reasons we do it is to bring awareness to domestic violence, because a lot of people aren't impacted by it, and then so they're not aware of it. I think that's one of the initial things we need to do. Is it impacts everybody in some way or another, and we can all make a difference. And so I think we have to reach those people that see it and hear about it and say, "Boy, that's tragic. It doesn't really affect me," and really get everybody together to kind of start spreading that word that this matters to all of us. Because if it matters to one of us, it should matter to all of us. And I think that's one of the initial things we have to do. People see about it, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Could you imagine that happening? But it doesn't affect them. And I think we need to reach those people as well. And then we need to keep this on the forefront of everybody's mind that when you see something in the news, it has impact. It might not impact you directly, but it has impact to others. We got to reach those people and engage those people. And then, frankly, keep it on the forefront. The mm-hmm. discussion. Just because it might come out of the news doesn't mean we don't exist and we shouldn't be continuing that messaging.
Do you think, Gary, we should have more training at workplaces? And do you think it should be almost like curriculum as early as elementary schools?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think we need to kind of, you know, I don't know what that curriculum would look like. I'd leave that to others. But I do mm-hmm. think that we need to bring awareness that your what you say matters and what you do matters. And these are the things that are appropriate and the things that aren't appropriate. You brought up earlier that, you know, sometimes high school kids or teenagers do things or say things and they don't really know the impact that they have. I'm sure all of us listening have saw something and said, boy, you know, I didn't realize that if I said that, that actually impacted someone in a different way. Mm-hmm. That's an important message to bring forward. So I think we need to continue to have that education throughout the community.
Gary McNamara, so glad to have you on the show this morning. Thank you so much for popping on. I hope to have you on again really soon.
You got it, Melissa. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. It has been quite the busy week. I wanted to start with actually talking about the cyber attack on JBS. Is that cool?
Fine.
Okay. I wanted to start with talking about this. The world's largest meat processing company says it will be resuming production at all of its plants today after being hit by this cyber attack. This is JBS USA, hacked over the weekend in a ransomware attack. It forced it to shut down all or most, I should say, of its U.S. operations. And the FBI said yesterday the attack was linked to a Russian-speaking gang. dare I say, we're seeing this again. I mean, we just had the pipeline not that long ago. Now you're seeing one of the largest meat processing companies on the globe. I mean, what are we kind of doing about this? I mean, I'm not putting it all on you, Senator Blumenthal, but I think this just continues to be something that really wreaks havoc, not just on companies or corporations, but really the nation.
When you ask the question, what are we doing about it? The question really is, who is the we? And obviously, ordinary citizens, nor even senators, can take action on their own. We have a cyber defense. We have a cyber defense team, which is spread across various agencies of the government, including the military. And as you know, because you and I have discussed it as recently as within the past few weeks, that cyber team has failed in many ways. And the causes are deep and important, but they begin with the failure of those corporations like JBS and others to take sufficient precautions. We've been pounding on their doors for years, telling them that they are vulnerable. But I've also complained about government agencies failing to take sufficient deterrent steps. You know, the best defense is a good offense. Well, in the world of cyber, as well as nuclear weapons, often deterrence depends on your adversary being convinced that there's a cost to pay if there's an attack. And as our cyber chief, General Nakasone, said about a year and a half ago, our enemies don't fear us in the cyber realm. And that's part of the problem as well. So it's the failure of corporations to prepare and take sufficient defensive steps, and the failure of our government to take adequate offensive steps when our country is attacked. And I hope that we can remedy both.
So let's dig into that actually a little bit deeper. Let's start with the government side of things. Is President Biden planning to talk to Russia? I don't know if that matters, but I'm just curious.
Well, it does matter, and that's a very, very good question, because Russia on occasion has directly attacked us, as happened with the SolarWinds incident. So has China, as happened with the Microsoft Exchange incident. You remember SolarWinds involved the Russian intelligence agency basically living in our government computers for several months. And our government learning about it only from private, in effect, private intelligence groups that discovered it and then reported it to the United States government. The biggest hack in the history probably of the free world or the world generally. And we learned about it only because a number of private companies that do this for a living found out about it. So, you know, should he talk to Putin about it? Absolutely. Is Russia harboring these cyber criminals? Yes.
Right.
And could it do something? Yes. So I think he has to come down very hard on both the Russian government activities and also its harboring cyber criminals.
And the other part of the Senator Blumenthal that you were saying has kind of failed on the U.S. front is corporations not taking enough action. When you say that, what are they lacking? I know that when you talk about protecting yourself from these cyber criminals, I mean, are these simple things that they're just ignoring? They think they're too big? Like, when you say they're failing, these corporations are failing, and they're part of the problem in not protecting themselves, what could they better do?
They could better disclose, for example, when they suffer attacks. Many of them have been attacked and ransomware demanded, and they very simply didn't want to tell the world about it. Obviously, there's some embarrassment involved in a big company like a utility or others being attacked in the cyber realm. But the ransomware demands have been made of school districts. For example, Hartford school district there was aided by the National Guard in untangling itself from a ransomware attack. And a variety of public agencies, as well as these corporations, and they need to be much more forthcoming about disclosing it, but they also need to link themselves to cyber defenses that are provided by the federal government. And they have reasons that they want to stay independent of the government. The federal government should not be interfering in their business, but they need to disclose where their vulnerabilities are so that the federal government can help them to, in effect, patch them.
We are still amidst the investigation of Senator Dennis Bradley, who is facing wire fraud charges that stem from his 2018 campaign to become a state senator. Joining me now is Maria Pereira. She is part of the Bridgeport Board of Education, has been a longstanding member. And apparently, Maria, my understanding is you sent the initial complaint out about Senator Bradley. Why did you initially complain about Senator Bradley? This wasn't recent, correct?
Right. I filed the complaint. I hand-delivered it to the State Elections Enforcement Commission in Hartford on June 29th, 2018. As far as I know, I'm the only person who filed a complaint regarding then-candidate Dennis Bradley, who was running for the state Senate representing the 23rd District. We were all Board of Education colleagues at the time. You should know that. Dennis Bradley was on the Board of Education. His treasurer, Jessica Martinez, was on the Board of Education. And I was also on the Board of Education.
So why did you file a complaint?
All the stuff on social media promoting this event at Dolphins Cove. And he claimed it wasn't a campaign event, yet he announced he was running. And although I did not attend the event personally, I had some people that I knew who attended it. And I asked them, were they collecting donations? And I had two different people tell me, yes, people were making donations. In addition, I decided to go to his social media page. It was called Bradley for Senate. And if you look at all his upcoming events and past events, it clearly was listed as a campaign event. March 15th, Bradley for Bridgeport, and the address of Dolphins Cove.
Again, we're talking to Bridgeport Board of Education member Maria Pereira, who made the initial complaint about Senator Bradley. Now, I'm looking at the complaint right here. It was filed in 2018, as you mentioned, when he was running. What was sort of the reaction from Senator Bradley?
I believed as a professional courtesy, I owed him the courtesy of letting him know that I filed a complaint. So I did call him, and I said, Dennis, I want to tell you this directly. I don't want to blindside you. I don't want you to hear this from anybody else, that I filed a formal complaint with the SEC regarding your Senate campaign. His response was incredible. He said to me, quote unquote, you're just jealous of me. And I said, excuse me, did you just say I was jealous of you? And he said, quote, you're just jealous of me because I'm so successful and I'm so good looking.
Now, this was a phone conversation between you and Senator Bradley. I say that just to make sure the record is straight, that this is coming from Maria Pereira, a phone conversation that was privately done between her as well as Senator Bradley. So how is it that we went almost 3 years? How then did we go until May of 2021 for him to be charged?
When you a state Senate candidate has to raise $15,000 of small campaign donations between five and I think at the time it was $250 to qualify for the state grant. So you have to raise $15,000 in the primary stage, and then the state's going to give you for as a state senator $84,000 if you qualify. If you are you win the primary, you then get a second batch of money for the general election. So Dennis and the treasurer then went and applied for the new $92,000. And I was very upset because I saw it on the SEC's agenda and I called the investigator. I said, I can't believe that with everything I provided that this is even moving forward. And the investigator was very appropriate and said to me, well, it's on the agenda. The commission has to vote on it. Well, that day, the commission denied it, which tells me that they already were unraveling what I was asserting in my complaint. What happened was COVID. COVID significantly delayed all these investigations.
So this was kind of already in the works, Maria Pereira, and then it just sort of had to halt, just like so many things with COVID, but it picked back up most recently?
Right, and I think the other issue was that the assistant U.S. attorney who's dealing with this is the same assistant attorney who apparently was involved in prosecuting Police Chief A.J. Perez and the former Acting Civil Service Director David Dunn.
Gotcha.
So maybe that was the initial effort, and right after that wrapped up, they moved into this. And that's just my guess.
Maria Pereira with the Board of Education in Bridgeport. Do you know of any other leaders in Bridgeport who are accused of wire fraud? The reason I ask this question is because you're clearly very close to the city of Bridgeport. And I look at someone like A.J. Perez, who was the former chief, David Dunn, who was the former personnel director, and now a state senator who, again, has not been convicted of anything, is only facing charges at this point. But again, it brings concern, does it not?
Well, I think people are often corrupted by power, right? You really get to see a person's character when they have power. Do they use that power for the greater good, or do they use that power poorly and to only benefit themselves, their friends, their family members? And what we often see in Bridgeport is that power corrupts people. I often say to people, I think so many people who originally want to get involved in Bridgeport politics do it for all the right reasons. They really initially want to do good things. They want to help others. And then what happens, they become entrenched in this corrupt democratic machine. And that machine definitely exists, okay? And they become corrupted by it, by the power. And instead of using it for the greater good, it's always about how can I use this power to benefit myself and my friends and my family? And that's not what we're supposed to run for office for. We're supposed to want to serve the people we represent, not for what's in it for me. And unfortunately, that's just often what happens in Bridgeport.
Maria Pereira with the Bridgeport Board of Education, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.